I think the moment that really, for all of us, that really just shocked the hell out of us was that we were parodied on Saturday Night Live. That felt like the fact that like anybody other than the people in our office and maybe my mom would get that joke. You know, I was just like, who even knows who the hell we are? You know, so that was really shocking.
It is one of the most popular podcasts of all time, a show that some claim has heralded in a podcast renaissance. But just how did Serial come together?
I was like a mad woman. I was ripping up structures and rewriting structures, and I would be sending emails to Sarah Koenig, the host, saying like, you're going to kill me, but I think I have a thought about the structure.
Yes, this week on Download This Show, the co-creator of Serial, Julie Snyder, talks about what she learned from her 18 years at This American Life, Serial's difficult second season, and she teases a brand new spin-off podcast. This is your guide to the week in media, technology, and culture. My name is Mark Fennell, and welcome to Download This Show. It is a very big welcome to our panelists this week. She is a digital creative. I promised myself I would not make fun of that job title at the agency 50 Acres. And Seamus Byrne, who has a job I actually understand, editor of the technology website CNET. Keep, welcome back.
Keep it simple. Thank you.
Yes, you are. No, thank you. Thank you. It's so very December. All right, first up this week, there is a war, I'm told, between the big banks of Australia and Apple. What is at stake in this war? I do not know. Who will win? I do not know. But you know who does know? Seamus Byrne knows. What's happened?
So, earlier in the year, our big banks...
I love your explainy voice.
Yeah, let me get down to the point here. Yeah, the big banks asked for permission to break the law and basically collude or work together as a cartel to negotiate with Apple over access to Apple Pay. And they realized they had to petition the ACCC to say, please, because Apple's so big that we poor little Australian mega banks can't negotiate with them one-on-one, even though ANZ already did it and is therefore the one bank offering
Apple Pay. Apple Pay. Yeah.
And the ACCC has handed down its draft finding saying, no, you cannot do this. There is no genuine benefit to Australian consumers in you guys getting together to make this negotiation.
So Apple Pay is, of course, the way in which you can pay at the point of sale with your phone or your Apple Watch. Why would you buy one? I don't know. So where do we go from here, Olivia Rosenman?
Well, I think, as Seamus said, it's a draft finding. The full final report is expected in March, but it's pretty sure that that's going to be a no. Where to go from here? I think ideally, hopefully, these three banks, it's three of the big four and Adelaide and Bendigo Bank that wanted to form this cartel, will probably just have to be forced to play by Apple's rules. So I think it's an interesting scenario because you've got the ACCC saying, no, you can't act like a cartel. And everyone's like, haha, stupid big Australian banks, because no one likes them.
No.
Because they've, you know.
It feels like Alien versus Predator. Like whoever wins, we lose.
Exactly. That's exactly right. Apple wins. These banks will have to play by Apple's rules. Apple has rolled out the Apple Pay in 12 countries with 3,500 banks. They're all playing by its rules. I don't know, pretty soon.
So what are these rules in question? Like what, in terms of actually what the banks want, what Apple wants, what's at play here?
Yeah, so Apple's deal is pretty simple. If you want to be using Apple Pay as part of your banking system, they get their little clip of the ticket. So I think it's something like a quarter of a percentage point or something like that. But you know, the banks themselves have always gotten, you know, their little, I guess maybe it's like 1.5% or, you know, something like that. Let's say for the sake of argument, that's the number. But they get their number and Apple saying, well, we want a tiny slice of that bit that you're already getting. Mm. And you're not allowed to pass on some extra fee to your customers for Apple Pay. You know, this has to be just a transparent thing that we get a little bit of what you get.
It has to eat into your money.
And that's where the banks are really upset on the idea that they can't negotiate that. And even part of their argument to the ACCC was trying to say that we should be able to actually force Apple to let us access directly the NFC chip in the iPhone, not just Apple Pay, but be able to do our own kind of system, you know, tap system like CommBank already has on, you know, Android phones and all that sort of stuff. Mm. And that's the bit that kind of blew my mind. It's like, I don't care how many Australian banks get together, Apple's just going to still say no. Like, Apple doesn't need these banks on their system.
So if that's the case, why did ANZ go with the deal? Were they banking on the fact that the level of excitement that Apple users would have outweighed the cut that they would get?
Yeah, just the marketing advantage of actually saying, look, we offer this, look at all our posters.
And it was a gamble, basically suggesting that the bump they would get from that would outweigh whatever cut they got, yeah?
Absolutely.
And I have read that they have actually got said bump.
Download the Show is what you are listening to. It is your guide to the week in technology, the media and culture. Our guests this week are Seamus Byrne, the editor of CNET Australia, Olivia Rosenman with the communications agency 50 Acres, Mark Fennell is my name. And now, it was the podcast that changed podcasting. It had been, I mean, let's be honest, podcasting had been around for a while, but Serial, the narrative crime investigation from the team behind This American Life, Sarah Koenig and Julie Snyder, it was water cooler storytelling. It blew up a media form that had been around for about a decade. And since then, it's also given rise to a whole new ecosystem of storytelling podcasts, but also new businesses as well. There are companies that have been birthed largely by looking at the commercial success of things like This American Life and Serial. And we're very lucky because earlier in the week I spoke to the co-creator, co-owner and editor of Serial, Julie Snyder. Right now she's getting set to come to Australia for the Sydney Opera House's huge Binge Fest, which is a celebration of popular culture, the internet and other things. And she's doing a talk, fascinating talk, about how to make binge-worthy journalism. And I sat down with her to talk a little bit about that.
My name is Julie Snyder, and I am the executive producer and co-creator of Serial.
You come from a background in, I guess, traditional radio, and there are sort of basic rules in traditional radio about good hooks and keeping people interested every 15 minutes. How transferable were those skills to when you started doing long-form storytelling?
Well, luckily, I came from a background that didn't have any of those rules. So I didn't have any rules.
So you were
just
in radio, but not learning anything.
That's actually very true. I don't think that we were doing any of those kinds of things. I think the rules that we were generally following were things that were much more, let's see, what kind of rules were we looking at? More narrative journalism rules of where you just certainly in any kind of storytelling you're doing, you want to have, you want to start a story with stakes. You know, you want to say what's at stake in the story. You want to have a feeling that by the time you get to the end, that something has happened and that it matters that it happens. And then as you're going along, you know, narrative storytelling a lot of times is a series of anecdotes, and you're sort of one anecdote after another, and then you're coming to sort of points of reflection or what does it mean? So those are the rules that I think I've generally kind of followed, and we brought those all with us straight up to Serial. I think probably the primary rule that I got from the working at the public radio show This American Life was that we should never be scared of contradiction and ambiguity. I think that was one of the main things that I took away. So if there is a character who is complicated or unlikable or sometimes likable, but in other ways they aren't, or they're funny or they're bizarre or they're upsetting, those are the things that you want more of that. That's what we're trying to do, is sort of reflect as much as we can of sort of real life and human condition. That's what we find to be the most compelling thing and helps us in our storytelling.
Was there a moment when you guys realized that Serial had gone from just being this thing that you had created, it was a bit of an experiment, to being a cultural touchstone that everybody was talking about? Was there a moment when that sort of dawned on you?
Yeah, I think so. It was very confusing at first. We did not expect it to be very... We thought that it was going to be around... We were told right before we launched that we were going to be shooting for 300,000 downloads, that we were told that's going to be... That's the respectable number. That's what you're shooting for. Hopefully, if you get 300,000, then you don't, walk around thinking you're a failure. And I think, like, most recently I checked that we're now 230 million downloads for seasons 1 and 2. So, it took a while for us to sort of understand what was going on. But I think the moment that really, for all of us, that really just shocked the hell out of us was that we were parodied on Saturday Night Live. And that felt like the fact that, like, anybody other than the people in our office and maybe my mom would get that joke, I was just like, who even knows who the hell we are, So that was really shocking.
If you had known how big it was going to be, what would you have done differently from the get-go?
Oh, that is interesting. If I had known, I mean, I think I probably would have been able to warn and prepare the people in the stories a little better. We did that then heading into season two of Serial, where we were able to, I think everyone kind of knew what they were getting into a little bit better. And we were able to say, like, look us up. If you haven't heard of us, look us up. You might kind of see, you know, that what happened with season one. And there, I have to say, there were certainly people who declined to be a part of our season two story because I think they had sort of seen the hoopla that came from season one.
What's your pitch when you have talent like that, when they're spooked? How do you try and get those people over the line?
You know, I think that it's a very personal question because usually everybody's saying, what's in it for me? Mm. You know, and I think it's a hard thing to answer because really only they can answer that question. So I think in that regard, like, I can kind of only lay out the reality of it and lay out the story that we're interested in doing and talk about what our hopes are. But then it really comes down to them of what they have at stake, you know? So, and I completely respect that. And if somebody does not want to participate, that's, you know, I'm bummed. I'm super, 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 super bummed. And I might try them one more time later to see if they've changed their mind. But you know, you move on.
One of the interesting and I guess sort of alarming side effects of certainly the first series of Serial was it engendered this sort of world of armchair detective work where people were checking into their private information. Can you do anything realistically as a producer to ensure that that doesn't become too invasive to people?
I don't know. And that's actually something that I really struggled with. I mean, after the fact, after we, you know, when I started seeing this taking place online, because there was sort of the armchair detectiving, also just mainly wild speculation happening online where I felt like I didn't. It seemed as though people didn't understand that writing things on the internet is a public space, you know, that they didn't fully appreciate that what you're saying is very, very public. Like, anybody can see this. It just was horrifying to me. And then releasing personal information and last names and photos and things that we had withheld, trying to protect privacy. It was upsetting. And so I had definitely, I mean, very early on, I had reached out to websites like Reddit and asked their moderators if they could create some rules for the thing. And they did. They did, much to their credit.
I'm actually surprised that they did. That's fascinating. You don't often hear people talk about Reddit being easy to work with and pro-moderation.
No, they were actually, honestly, they were very responsive. And I think they also were a little like, what is happening? You know, there was sort of a meltdown. I think it just got, it ended up just getting a little too big. Like, it's nobody's full-time job to moderate and monitor those boards. So, I mean, they're all just volunteers. So I think after a while, just got too big and overwhelming for them. We reached out to websites and newspapers and asked them to remove information and photographs and last names and stuff like that. And I would have to say also, for the most part, most newspapers and websites were very kind about it and did do that. I'd leave the British press aside because they do not follow those rules. So yeah, those guys were not those
very specific set of rules govern British press.
Yes.
You're coming out to Australia to do a talk about how to make binge-worthy journalism. And so what are the basic principles of binge-worthy journalism, journalism that will sustain over several episodes separated by time?
I mean, I think that for the most part, I don't have rules. You know, I haven't done this enough to really be able to go out and tell people these are the rules.
But if you don't know after 200 million downloads, who does know?
I know. Well, I think I know what we've done. But, you know, what was interesting is that we did the first season of Serial. And then when we went in, I felt pretty, that went pretty well. And then as we headed into the second season, I really, really struggled with primary. My job a lot of times is primarily, I'm the editor on the show as well. So I'm macro and micro. And so on the macro level, a lot of it comes down to structuring, you know, and structuring the order of the story overall and structuring the individual episodes. And I struggled with that so much during the entire second season of Serial. I was like a mad woman. I was ripping up structures and rewriting structures. And I constantly, we were halfway through and I would be sending emails to Sarah Koenig, the host, saying like, I saw two emails that were subject lined, you're going to kill me, but I think I have a thought about the structure. and just ripping stuff apart. And I think part of the reason that I was having a harder time in the second season was because I wasn't sure what was exactly instructive from what I had learned off the first season, if that makes sense. It was still very much present in my head. And I didn't know, are the things we did on the first season, are these rules about things that I have to be following or not? You know, like I didn't quite understand if there was a format yet or not. And so that was very difficult. But now we're releasing our first spinoff that will be in March. So we're halfway through writing that right now. And that one, I feel like now that we've gotten the second season away, out of the way, it's been much easier, that my mind is sort of open again. And I don't have rules. I don't have things that say you have to have this in order to have binge-worthy journalism is going to work. But I can talk about the things that I feel like have worked for us, which is primarily that we've got an overarching question, but we're very narrative based inside of a world and inside of people and their motivations. And I think we're just trying to bring all of that to life as much as possible, so that somebody, you know, they come across in all of the sort of real and complicated ways that they are.
You mentioned a spinoff there coming in March next year. How is a spinoff in this case different to, say, just a third series of Serial?
Well, this one will be hosted by a different person.
Yep.
This one will be hosted by Brian Reed, who is a reporter and a producer for This American Life. And, you know, this one, I feel like when it starts, it's going to maybe seem a little similar to Serial, but then, like, to the Serial style or something. But then I think we're going to kind of take a left turn. I find it very, it's a little arty and novelistic. And we've got different inspirations for what's guiding us. It'll also be a little bit shorter. I think we're looking at, well, I'm saying 7 episodes right now. That could give or take one or two.
In your time at This American Life, what was the biggest change since you started on the show?
You know, This American Life really went, I've been at This American Life for 18 years. So I have seen a lot of iterations of it, but I think probably the biggest change was after September 11th. I think up to that point, This American Life, the sort of ethos of the show had been using the tools of journalism, to tell the stories of everyday lives. And I think after September 11th, in a lot of ways for us, it felt like our interest and to talk about everyday life, it was national security and terrorism and what was being done by the administration and wars. That was part of our everyday life. And so at that point, I felt like we kind of flipped it, and it was using the tools of sort of narrative of storytelling, of everyday life storytelling on traditional topics that are generally covered in sort of topical journalism and in daily journalism. So we began covering a lot more topical issues and taking on issues like the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and gun violence and healthcare. And that for me felt like it was really when This American Life kind of blossomed into a whole new thing.
In the creation of an episode of This American Life, are they thinking more about the linear broadcast, or are they thinking more about the podcast audience?
You know, it's interesting that we don't spend a lot of time thinking about the audience at all, which I think it sounds callous and harsh, but I think honestly it's more in the matter of, we're not focus grouping stories, you know what I mean? Yeah. We're not thinking about what's going to be a hit or what people are going to, you know, like or not like. On the other hand, I think more what we're usually doing is following our own taste and kind of operating off of a sort of golden rule approach to the whole thing. You know, if this is something we would want to hear, then we would hope that other people want to hear it. And generally, that's kind of served us pretty well. This is something I like, so I'm hoping that there are people out there that this is probably something they'll like. My tastes are pretty, and I know Ira Glass feels the same way. Our tastes in media are rather vanilla. I mean, I basically like the same TV shows that everybody else likes. I like the same movies. I like the same books. You know, I don't. We're not particularly avant-garde. So for the most part, I think, you know, if we like it, probably there are a lot of other people out there that'll like it too.
Do you imagine that linear broadcast radio, as we currently know it, exists in 20 years? The sort of radio that you make, the sort of audio content you make, is it going to shift entirely to an on-demand environment in, say, the next 20 years or so?
I know. I'm terrible at predicting this. I feel like whatever
you know, the
I say,
quote's going to come should, back to bite you at some point, right?
Well, I also feel like you should just go out and buy stock in whatever is the opposite that I'm about to say, because I have a negative capacity to predict trends in the future. But certainly to me, it seems like, you know, the internet seems like it's here to stay, and a lot
that
of things
one you can have, take to the bank. I think.
Yeah, have bent toward it. So I, you know, obviously, I mean. Now, I think, with Serial and the new shows we're developing, they're all podcast only. And part of that has to do with our budgets. It's much more expensive to develop a radio show.
Yeah.
So right now we're developing only podcast only stories. And I think for something like This American Life now, their listenership is about 50-50, 50% terrestrial radio and 50% podcast. And that's the podcast audience is merely, it's grown. It has not affected the terrestrial radio audience. That has stayed consistently the same number. And instead, it's just the podcast audience that's grown. So, you know, they exist side by side. We'll see how everything sort of bends toward each other.
In your time working in public radio, there's also been a launch of a number of companies that are pretty clearly inspired by the blueprint that was laid out by NPR and This American Life and Serial. And I guess the obvious one looking at here is a company like Gimlet Media. Do you feel a sense of pride as though you've birthed you as a unit, maybe not you personally, that you've birthed a sort of category of media?
It's funny because at Gimlet was started by Alex Bloomberg. He's the CEO of Gimlet Media, and he is a former, he's my former colleague. He is a former producer on This American Life. And yeah, I mean, obviously, yeah, he's just taking, you know, that's what I did. I took what I know from This American Life, and I moved it over to Serial, and we're creating that stuff with the same ethos. And he's kind of, he was birthed from the same womb. So he's taken it over to Gimlet, and he's making it there. And there are a lot of former This American Life producers who are kind of going out and creating all these new shows now.
Has really he ever exciting. Tried to poach you?
Oh, yeah, of course.
So what keeps you with the Ira Glass clan, for
Alex
lack of a better term?
Alex can't afford me.
Alex can't afford me. You, really?
No. Well, it is what it is.
Yeah, right. So it is about the money. It's not about the capacity to reach audiences that come with This American Life sort of pedigree, I guess.
I mean, you know, we're creating. I'm very excited and very happy over at Serial right now. Serial is I own Serial with Sarah Koenig and Ira Glass, and now we're creating new shows from Serial Productions and with our new spinoff. I'm very creatively fulfilled. So I don't feel like I don't need to go work for anyone else.
As an editor and as a creator and a producer, how do you know when an episode is done?
Oh, that's interesting. An episode of a serialized storytelling? How
yeah.
do I know when it's
when
done?
Are you confident yeah. that this is exactly what this episode should be?
I mean, you know, there's a certain level of it where it feels like you've a lot of times they're structured in a way of where you can kind of tell that a question or an idea was posed at the very beginning. And if you've, you know, it's done when you've reached the answer or the conclusion, you know, to whatever was at stake, you've come to the ending. So I think that's how I know it's done, that we've sort of come full circle and have provided, sort of landed in a different space, but one that speaks to where we started at the beginning.
Julie, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
Julie Snyder there from Serial, co-creator, in fact, of Serial, and she will be in Australia at the Binge Fest event, which is happening at the Sydney Opera House. Now, almost 20% of Australians live with a disability of some kind. And all this week on RN, we are hearing from the 1 in 5. And Alzheimer's Australia have been doing this incredibly interesting thing where they are using virtual reality headsets, basically little Google Cardboard headsets, to give dementia carers at the front line a real understanding of what it's like to live with dementia.
The scenario that we've built this around is a person living with dementia getting up in the middle of the night to find the toilet.
Marie McCabe, I'm the CEO of Alzheimer's Australia.
Tanya Petrovic, I'm the Business Development Manager for Alzheimer's Australia Vic. Okay, so EDI is an acronym for Educational Dementia Immersive Experience. And the idea is that we are giving people an experience of standing in the shoes of a person with dementia and seeing the world through their eyes. So we've used the Google Cardboard platform to give people an immersive experience and a 360-degree view of the world. So getting up in the middle of the night, clearly it's dark. And if there are obstacles in the person's way, clearly that's an issue. But also the way that the person perceives their environment can be concerning. So in the scenario, we've used a lot of patterns on the wallpaper and on the floor to explain to people that the perception of patterns can be confronting for people and they can perceive things differently. Shadows can be perceived as being a person or possibly an animal, and a person with dementia might even have hallucinations. For a person living at home, this is a major issue in terms of finding the bathroom, but also the number of times a person gets up in the middle of the night might increase with dementia as well.
In terms of the biggest misconceptions you encounter as you go around putting this headset on people, what are the things that people seem to most learn from it?
I think particularly the wallpaper and the patterns. I think people don't understand that a busy environment, visually busy environment, can really be overstimulating and confronting for a person. And in addition to that, the noise or you know what's happening in the environment in terms of noise levels can also be overstimulating for a person.
And once people can actually stand in the world of somebody living with dementia, it changes their attitude, which changes their behaviour, and that in turn changes their practice, leading to better quality of care and life for people living with dementia.
How do you quality control it in the sense that how do you get somebody to say, yes, this is what it actually feels like?
Absolutely. So at each point, we have spoken with carers and people living with dementia, and all of the scenarios are built around true stories. So it's real experiences that we've built this around. So we haven't, built something and then said to people, does this look like dementia? It's actually working with people, understanding what dementia is, and then creating the scenarios.
One really good example is a carer who had participated in the virtual dementia experience training and went back to her workplace and went to shower one of her residents who she'd been working with for some time. And every morning, the resident would get upset when she was taken to the shower. And this particular morning, the carer took her to the shower and the resident got upset. And the carer thought, hang on, I know how to deal with this. And she ran back into the resident's room, got her glasses, put them on, and the resident went, oh, it's the shower. Now, that resident showers every day with her glasses on and is quite happy to get into the shower. And so gone are the months and months of upset that it was causing to the resident because carers didn't understand that there was a concern, a fear about what the resident was actually going to step into.
Thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate both of you coming down.
Oh, thanks, Mark, and thank you for being willing to raise awareness about this. It's really important.
The team from Alzheimer's Australia there talking about Edie. This is their new virtual reality headset helping carers understand exactly what it's like to live with dementia there. That, ladies and gentlemen, is our show for this week. Very big thank you to our panellists. Thanks for being back on the show, Olivia Roseman and Shandam Spurn.
Thank you.
If you happen to be on a podcast app, by all means, leave us a nice review. We'd love for you to do that, not just because it services my very fragile ego because I was not hugged enough as a child. It's also a very important way in which people find the show, so we do appreciate when you do it. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is all I have time for. If you happen to be listening to this on the radio, Patricia Karvelis is up next. This was Download This Show.